Hello. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here at 10 o'clock. I know when I got the time slot announcement, I was worried no one would come, but delighted to see you all here. So welcome to Making Sense of the Ether, Connecting Radio Frequencies with Public Data. So I'm Mark DaCosta. I am kind of both a radio and a data nerd of different stripes. I do a lot of work working with public records and public data and kind of combining them, cleaning them, and trying to make them useful as a way to understand the world in which we live. I'll just go back quickly. Some of the notes and references and slides and stuff are available on a GitHub repo, which you can find there if you're interested. So I'm going to be talking a lot about public data in this talk, and I thought as a good way to kind of kick things off and start, I wanted to kind of set a little bit of parameters and give you guys a little bit of a look and feel of what I mean when I talk about public data. So kind of run through some examples. Public data is kind of amazing because you can kind of think of it as like the exhaust that comes off of government regulation in a way. So this is an example. It's a Federal Election Commission filing from the Trump campaign years ago, and you can see it's a $140 Uber disbursement. And what's really cool about this data set is you can see, you know, all of the line items of those sorts of things. This is, of course, a McDonald's drive-through, and you might say, what does this have to do with public data? But what's really cool, and what I'll be talking about a little bit later, is most of the McDonald's drive-throughs in the country are connected to the restaurants through commercial radios, which means that you can find records of them in public data and use them to understand what's going on. You know, also, this is just a slide from a 990 kind of not-for-profit tax filing. And you can see some curators at the Museum of Modern Art in the city here make a tremendous amount of money. What's really cool, anytime you walk into an elevator, you probably see a placard like this. And every state has, you know, a record of every elevator in the state and who runs it and how fast it is and things like that. This is a copy of the deed for the hotel that we're standing in. Aircrafts, of course, are all registered, and I think there's 100,000 or so of them registered in the country, which you can all go find. And this is actually one of my favorite examples of public data. It's an import bill of lading record from the return of the Apollo 11 moon mission, because they were importing moon rocks into the Earth. They had to fill out a form. And, you know, I think it goes a long way to kind of understanding like all of the kind of weird stuff that is reflected in public data. I'm sure a lot of you guys have been to HOPE before, and of course Club Mate is a part of the experience and the culture. And I was really excited to see like what could I find out about Club Mate in public data as an example. And you might be surprised to know, but the 2,600 Enterprises Incorporated imported almost 2,700 kilograms of Club Mate for the event here. And what's really cool is, you know, I was able to go search through the public records and find that, you know, they all came from this brewery in Germany, which has really cool machines that are used to manufacture and to brew the Club Mate. It, you know, went to Bremerhaven port on the 30th of April this year, went into a very specific shipping container, sailed on a very specific ship, the Vecchio Bridge, and then arrived in the port of Newark, just 2 months before the event. And so we can, of course, thank that wonderful supply chain for being able to be at 10 o'clock tonight. In any event, you know, to sort of just grant that as a little bit of groundwork and get down to really the meat of the talk, I want us to kind of think about how we can use the RF spectrum in public data to help really understand the world around us. And I'm sure as many of you know, the electromagnetic spectrum is really big. You know, we of course usually live in this like tiny little slice of the visual spectrum that we sort of see, but you know, across all of this, there's a very big band of things that we usually think about as radio. Radio is, of course, one of the people that's really given credit for its invention is Marconi. And in the early 20th century, when it was being commercialized, it was happening, you know, under a context without regulation, and it was really kind of a free-for-all. And interestingly, the sinking of the Titanic is kind of considered to be one of the origin moments of the current regime of sort of electromagnetic spectrum regulation we have right now. You know, the Titanic was kind of a state-of-the-art ship at the time. It had an onboard radio transmission station, and when the ship ran into trouble, they were broadcasting SOS signals. But what sort of came out later was that because of all of the radio frequency interference on the land-based stations and cities and things like this, those SOS signals didn't really come through. And so this sort of by extension wound up leading to the Radio Act of 1912, which set the groundwork for the current FCC and the sort of regulatory regimes that we have at the moment. And what's really interesting about that, and this image will be a little bit of a touchstone throughout the talk, is that, you know, given all of this kind of government regulatory systems that are in place, we have a really clearly demarcated and a really hyper-specific set of rules about how and for what the radio spectrum can be used. So this map is really interesting. I think it goes something from 3 kilohertz all the way up basically to 30 gigahertz, and along the way it allocates those bands for different uses. So just to zoom in a little bit here to kind of put this into a bit of context that maybe will be more familiar, we can see sort of in the top center there, we've got a band basically from 88 megahertz to 108 megahertz that of course is carved out for FM broadcast radio like we listen to in our car or whatever. But also, you know, one thing that I think is really interesting to kind of recognize is that, you know, along this spectrum, there are so many different zones that are cut out for different uses. So you can see a little bit further down the spectrum, I guess, in the kind of 150 megahertz zone is where maritime ship position data is broadcast on the radio spectrum, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that later. And you know, even kind of continuing down, we can see that there's a big chunk reserved for things like aircraft navigation, and each one of these little slots has all sorts of, you know, very specific both people that are allowed to use it and applications and protocols for which it is used. And, you know, of course, the radio spectrum is like a highly, you know, politicized and economically important thing. You know, just recently with the kind of retirement of analog television broadcasting, big swaths of the spectrum were opened up. And, you know, last year there was a large auction and you had $20 billion changing hands basically for that spectrum. You know, as you can see, the people that are buying it are like T-Mobile and AT&T and Dish Network and folks like that. But this is, you know, sort of certainly a very active and important space. And, you know, the kind of upside of the regulatory regime in which all of this stuff sits is that there's a tremendous amount of kind of data exhaust and information about how this spectrum is being used that's produced. Not necessarily very easy to work with, but it is kind of out there. And in the United States, the two main sort of databases that exist are both run by the FCC. The first one at the top, as you can see, you know, looks like something from the 90s, and it is. It's the Universal Licensing System, and it's certainly the place where you can get the richest degree of data about how the spectrum is being used. So each different class has its own sort of forms and things that get filled out, and they all sort of flow there. A project that came out of the FCC under the Obama administration at reboot.fcc.gov is this license view database. And what's really nice about that is it drops out a lot of the ancillary fields and the really high resolution that you get from the Universal Licensing System, but the upside of that is you can go and get sort of one file that describes more or less all of the licenses that exist. And the great thing about that is, you know, in the US there's about 30 million licenses that have been given out. And these things run the spectrum from you know, from a McDonald's drive-through to a Verizon base station. And so it's really quite a rich thing. This data itself is a little tricky to work with. This is a link to a GitHub repo of a repository I made that sort of helps you bootstrap working with this data. So we'll sort of download it, load it into a Postgres database that you presumably have running locally, geocode it, and sort of do some basic cleaning. And the thing that's interesting about this data set and having it sort of prepared in that form is you can really start asking questions of it straight out of the gate. So this, which I hope you guys can see, is just a really simple geo query that I did of this data set to basically ask the question, who are the people within a kilometer of this hotel that have radio licenses? And by doing this, and this of course varies by location, but you can start to understand, who are the actors, who are the people that are kind of out there, living in the broader spectrum around us. Not surprisingly, where we are now, both the city of New York and the NYPD really have the lion's share of the spectrum around us. But you also start to learn, other things about the kind of local environment that we are. So there's a lot of TV studios, so we can see, Fox and NBC and CBS and other folks. This is what sort of one a little bit further down that jumped out at me that was really surprising kind of in my broader investigations in New York was to realize that Northrop Grumman has a massive wireless network in the city. They have thousands and thousands of transmitters spread across. And, at first blush, seeing a defense contractor with such a big network in the city was quite surprising. Apparently, it's part of a what wound up being a very underutilized city-level wireless network that was deployed, but certainly interesting to see. And at the bottom, we can see both McDonald's and a Swiss bank are well represented here. And so, I don't know how familiar you all are with using software-defined radios and sort of how that technology has evolved over the last maybe 10 years at this point, but it's really great. There's, because of the influx of low-cost digital TV tuners, there were some very clever hackers that realized that you could basically repurpose the chipsets in those tuners in order to not just tune into broadcast television, but really take a pretty broad range, I think somewhere from maybe 30 megahertz to just over a gigahertz. And they're like $20 or less, and really great tools for getting started with exploring all of the transmissions that are in the air around us. There's really great, sort of software around there. This is sort of a really easy standard one called GQRX, which is a tuner built on GNU radio that, right now 93.9 megahertz is what it's tuned to, which is the local National Public Radio affiliate, but you could just as easily tune into any sort of simplex transmissions that are happening on any bit of that band that the tuner can go into. So of course today we're gathered in the Hotel Pennsylvania, which I don't know if anyone here has seen this Netflix documentary called Wormwood. It's a bit of an aside, but very interesting documentary by Errol Morris about a government scientist in the 50s that was thrown out of a window of a hotel for objecting to biological weapons research that the government was doing. And it just so turns out that actually was this hotel, which is something I discovered recently. It had a different name then. But the great thing is we can start to dig into this FCC data and even start to ask questions of, what's going on in this very hotel. So I looked up the Hotel Pennsylvania and found, some sort of interesting ancillary information. We can find, okay, here's the actual license filing they have. We can see there's a call sign in there that could be interesting. This stuff is also really great. There were some social engineering talks lately, but in terms of, starting to understand some of the management structure of organizations. So this was really interesting because we were able to find this fellow, Eugene Rudderman, who's actually the director of engineering of the hotel and is in charge of all the licenses. And this hotel, like many other businesses, uses sort of a third party to actually file and manage these kind of regulatory licenses. And here at the bottom, we can see that's a Micromagic two-way, which can all be useful bits of information to know. But what's great about this is by finding this license, we can then kind of back into what are the particular broadcast frequencies that the hotel is using. And it's, you know, super interesting. They have, it looks like, over 100, you know, radio units that they're permitted to use. And these are sort of the frequencies on which they transmit. So if you were to use, you know, GQRX, assuming these are simplex transmissions, it's a little more complicated if it's like a trunk radio system. But this is presumably where, you know, the bellhops will be called and the maintenance and all these sorts of things, which can be interesting for a bunch of reasons. And to kind of come back and kind of put this stuff back in context, this is again kind of a zoom in on that kind of 450 to 500 megahertz bit of that broader spectrum map. And we can see that, you know, all of these different uses of the wireless spectrum are, you know, they kind of live next door to each other. So here we can see, you know, the Hotel Pennsylvania coming in the 460 range. And just a bit further down is the reserve section for law enforcement and things like that. But, you know, this, the usage of kind of public data and of software-defined radio certainly goes beyond just picking up voice transmissions. So this is the NOAA 19 satellite. It's very cool. It's an Earth imaging satellite. I think it revisits the surface of the Earth, you know, once every maybe 10 or 14 days or something like that. And what's really interesting is, you know, it's up there in space, it's taking these photos, and the way it gets the photos back down to Earth is it just kind of beams them down in an unencrypted way. So these satellites, you know, the downlink happens at 137 megahertz, and as you can see, it's kind of cool, you know, there are these kind of dedicated bits of the spectrum that are for space downlink transmissions. And a friend of mine actually built an antenna that was sort of optimized for picking up those sorts of transmissions, and from his rooftop in Brooklyn was actually able to download directly from the satellite the images that it's blasting down. The caveat there is you need to know when the satellite will be overhead, but because they follow very predictable paths, he actually set up something that put Google Calendar reminders in his calendar so that he knew when to go outside. But you know, there's more that we can do than just sort of being in a relationship with the radio sort of spectrum where we're just kind of, you know, passively downloading. A project that I worked on a little while ago is kind of asking the question of, you know, could we use public data and radios to effectively look inside of cargo ships? So what's really interesting, here is, you know, kind of a shot of, you know, maybe like a fishing, like a small sort of private boat or whatever, and as you can see, not surprisingly, these boats are just loaded with radios of all different kinds. You know, here we've got, you know, there's a cell repeater for use on board, Wi-Fi, of course, GPS. And up here on the left, you can see a really important thing called the AIS Class B antenna. So AIS stands for Automated Identification System, and it's basically like a safety protocol. So every time a ship is underway, it sends out regular transmissions that basically announce, you know, who the ship is and its heading and speed and things like that. Those radios have a fairly limited range when you're on the surface, so you have to be more or less line of sight, which is fine when you're out at sea, but picking them up in the city can become difficult. However, on the flip side, there are companies like Marine Traffic and others that actually lease satellite kind of reception capacity, and they produce these really amazing real-time ship position maps by listening to these transmissions. What's cool, though, is if you are in sort of, you know, eyesight of a port or of a waterway, these things are fairly simple to pick up. So using one of these $20 SDR dongles, and there's a, you know, really nice program called RTL AIS, which is, you know, it's like works on Mac or Linux, and it's built off of GNU Radio, and it sets up a really simple server that basically decodes in a first step what's coming across the frequency into the kind of underlying packets of data that are there. So this is just kind of a screenshot example of what each of these individual messages look like. Not super useful in that format, but they do come across in kind of clear text like that once you decode them. And so in this project, I was like, okay, I set up a receiver on Governor's Island, which is sort of right at the mouth of New York Harbor, and was, you know, starting to pull all of these messages down. But, you know, I certainly wanted to get to the point where I could move from just these kind of encoded messages into stuff that I could start to work with. So there's, you know, just a great, there's a pretty clear spec on how this encoding happens. Someone made a really nice Python library called libAIS, which lets you go from those payload, those message payloads, which is basically what's just being put in line 4 into that function, and from that pull out the structured data that it contains. And as you can see here, there's things like, you know, rate of turn and, you know, XY coordinates of where the ship is. But importantly, you also get in this transmission something called an MMSI number. And MMSI stands for Mobile Maritime Subscriber Identifier. And that's basically like, you could think of it as like the cell phone number of the ship or whatever. It's how you would address a radio transmission directly to the ship. And what's nice is the UN, through the International Telecommunication Union, maintains, they have a, you know, as you can see, kind of a pretty primitive search form, but one that's easy enough to kind of put a scraper around. And it lets you turn that MMSI number into information about the ship's registry. So here, I don't know if you guys can read, but you know, I had seen a cargo ship that had a Liberian flag, the ER Sweden. And so that's great. Once you know the name of the ship and you know the kind of time of the observation and where it happened, you can then take the step of starting to look inside of it. So in the United States, as an example, the Customs and Border Protection Office is the agency that deals with all of these bills of lading, which are the kind of customs tax filings that have to come in advance of cargo being offloaded from a ship. And they all have, of course, the vessel name as sort of a somewhat unique identifier. What's kind of crazy about this data is the Customs and Border Protection Office is the only, they're the only folks that have that data in the U.S., or at least they're the primary generator of it. And the only way they make it available to anyone is on CD-ROM. So it's $100 per day, and if you pay that, you can go to the office and pick up a CD-ROM, and therein lies lots of kind of fixed-width files that describe all the shipping containers that are sort of due in that day. A company that I started years ago called Enigma has a whole sort of search engine of these sort of public records, and one of the things that we aggregate is these bills of lading. So by effectively being able to you know, sit on Governor's Island with a radio, listen and sort of set up a series of scripts to listen to the ships going by and join them with this underlying information from the bill of lading registry, you're actually able to kind of see what's going on inside the ship, be it pallets of club mate or you know, buckets of widgets or whatever it might be. So that's kind of like, you know, one example that hopefully will kind of get you guys thinking a little bit about sort of how we can use, you know, sort of real-time data gathering through, you know, things like software-defined radios, and then this kind of contextual outside information that can kind of help us make some sort of sense of what it is that's going on. I don't know how many of you guys have seen this story, but at BuzzFeed, over the last couple of years, they've come out with a series of stories effectively tracking law enforcement usage of stingrays. And you know, a common way in which stingrays are used are by basically putting them in helicopters or small aircraft and flying them in circles above, you know, a target, so that it sort of becomes a persistent fake cell phone tower that those phones are getting caught up in. So similar to the AIS transmissions that ships have, planes broadcast a sort of positioning information data called ADS-B. And as we can see, there's actually a pretty big chunk of the spectrum that's carved out for that. And it is one of these things that if you do get an SDR, it's like a great kind of hello world, because you know, pretty much wherever you are, there's going to be some sort of air traffic going on overhead, and there's lots of really easy tools that you can download to just kind of jump in immediately. This is one, if you're interested, that's good for Mac OS called Cocoa 1090, called 1090 because that's the 1090 megahertz is usually where these things are broadcast. And so you can see, this is from that BuzzFeed article by Peter Aldhouse and some other folks, where they were looking around New York City, had just sort of set up one of these receivers, were pulling in all this information, and then started to analyze it for flight paths that were kind of going in these repeated circles, because, you know, it's certainly like a kind of anomalous and unusual way to fly a plane unless you're doing something like this. And likewise, if you go to the FAA, there's something called the FAA Aircraft Registry, which is really cool because it has all of the information about, you know, every plane that's registered to fly in the U.S., its tail number, owner, and so on and so forth. And so one of the things they were able to do in this story is working with a third-party vendor that actually collects this kind of ADS-B data for the whole country. They were able to basically go to the FAA registry, search for airplanes that, you know, are actually registered to like Homeland Security or other potentially interesting government agencies, find those tail numbers, and then query this broader data set of all the flight paths to see which ones exhibited that sort of anomalous flying in a circle behavior that indicates the likelihood of a stingray being used. They actually took it also a step further, which was, I think, really interesting, is they were able to, using sort of some somewhat simple machine learning techniques, to basically observe planes that they knew to be used by law enforcement in order to to basically go out with stingrays for surveillance, and use that basically as training data into a classifier to kind of figure out like what are the maybe underlying patterns of that kind of flying of a plane, and then use that to apply to all of the flight records they had. And by doing that, they were able to identify a bunch of additional airplanes that were registered to shell companies that wouldn't obviously be operated by DHS or someone like that, but who, you know, certainly had suspicious kind of flight pattern activity, and then who, upon further investigation, they were able to find that those shell companies did have what seemed to be kind of clear links to law enforcement agencies. And these sorts of techniques and sort of thinking about how radios and the sort of ancillary data can be used to understand the world can become important for, you know, all sorts of reasons. And so, you know, I was speaking with someone who was an activist that was at the Standing Rock protests a few years ago, and they were actually collecting ADS-B data while they were there, specifically trying to identify and become aware of when stingrays were sort of being used in the vicinity. And so I think it certainly, that was a very interesting example to me, because it sort of speaks to, I think, some of the creative and sort of expanded applications of this kind of technology. And of course, I think, like, importantly, we live in a world that's, you know, utterly saturated with wireless infrastructure of all different kinds. And, you know, all of these things are existing on different parts of the spectrum, and, using either, you know, cheap or slightly more expensive SDRs, there are things that we can interrogate and try to understand, and, oftentimes actually discover really important things. There was a workshop given earlier today by Brannon Dorsey, who's a really interesting kind of artist researcher, who did a project on the pager networks. So what's kind of crazy as an example about pagers is they're still actually used quite a bit in this country, but largely in hospitals and by doctors. And the crazy thing about pagers is that, you know, all of the traffic is not only unencrypted, but it's broadcast to the entire city. It's the pager itself that sort of self-selects which messages to pull out of the air and display. But using an SDR, it's relatively trivial to make sort of like a super pager that will just receive and decode all of the messages going through a city. And this, of course, has like massive implications when you think about the fact that, you know, today pagers are basically just part of hospital infrastructure, and consequently, have a tremendous amount of sometimes very personal and potentially compromising information about people. You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting is, you know, not only this question of how can we engage the spectrum around us, but how can we use this sort of more general residue about how the radio spectrum is being used to kind of dig into other, I guess, issues of concern. When I was working with this FCC licensed spectrum database, one of the things that I became really curious about is, you know, what does the radio activity look like along the U.S.-Mexico border. So this is just a really kind of simple, somewhat interpolated map of, you know, all of the radio licenses that are that have been issued within 10 kilometers of the border. And so when I was looking at that, you know, I started to kind of explore and zoom in, and, you know, these are some examples of, you know, what these kind of licenses look like when they're mapped onto, you know, pretty big metropolitan centers. So you can see, as you'd expect, like kind of pretty broadly distributed, these things are going all over the place. But as I was kind of digging in a little bit more and kind of following the border along, I just kind of observed these sort of patterns of kind of, you know, evenly spaced antennas being installed in places that, you know, there really wasn't much other radio activity happening. And so I became really curious about, like, what, you know, who are installing these things, what are they being used for, like, what's going on here. This one here you can see was put on or sort of filed by this company IMSAR. So I started looking and said, okay, what does IMSAR do? Well, I found out that, you know, IMSAR is basically a company that makes kind of the ground radar modules for predator drones and other things like that. So I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, presumably they're sort of trying to set up some sort of like radar networks along the border. So it's kind of interesting. So I sort of wanted to dig in a little bit more deeply, and I said, okay, you know, for all of these radio licenses along this kind of, in this kind of 10-kilometer band along the border, you know, what's going on? What's the activity been like? Who are filing these things? So one of the things that I think is actually really interesting to note about this data set is, as you might expect, there's, like, of course, many different classes of FCC licenses you can file. You know, there are ones that are really specific to, like, commercial radio, like you might use at a McDonald's or in a hotel. There are others that are really specific for, you know, putting out, you know, 100 megawatt or 100 watt whatever sort of like FM sort of broadcast stations or whatever. But then there's also a really interesting class of experimental licenses. And these are things that, you know, usually hardware manufacturers or others will file for. And they only kind of generally last for a window of time. And they, you know, basically the FCC gives people permission to sort of do stuff that, you know, maybe hasn't been fully vetted in terms of how it's going to impact, you know, the broader spectrum, but in order to run an experiment to sort of prove stuff. So this is just a count and sort of view into all of these experimental licenses that were being filed along the border. And so I started to kind of dig in and say, well, who are these companies? So I started researching them. And all the ones with red arrows next to them are, you know, effectively defense contractors. So it was you know, really interesting for me to learn that, and I guess not so surprising in hindsight, but that, you know, there's actually kind of you know, hundreds of individual experiments that are sort of starting to be launched by defense contractors, presumably in advance of sort of competing for business and things like that, to start to install sort of some sort of surveillance network there. And as I actually started digging into these companies and sort of asking who is it that is sort of actively experimenting along the border, I wound up on a lot of kind of very strange websites, I would say. So, you know, one of the big companies there was called TCOM. They make these inflatable, I think they're called aerostatic, sort of basically like drones that they can stick in place and they can stay aloft for a long time in their sort of stable sort of surveillance platforms. You know, there's a company called Leonardo DRS, which is an Italian defense contractor that does a lot of work with the U.S. government, and they sort of have lots of materials like that. Another one, Telefonix, that also sort of sells these ground radars. Another one, which is, this is an Israeli defense contractor, ELTA, that makes a lot of, you know, one of the things that they do a lot of is, you know, sort of border surveillance stuff for sort of the Israeli-Palestinian border, as well as sort of anti-ballistic missile radar systems and things like that. Another one, Elbit Systems, which has, you know, a lot of these sort of both optical and radio surveillance platforms that are used. And it's interesting, a lot of this technology wound up getting kind of developed and refined as a result of sort of United States' military activity in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where there was sort of a need to be able to stand up these sort of surveillance systems. And so certainly, like, now that, you know, I sort of had found hundreds of these kind of radio experiments, I was curious to see, you know, where can we go from there? Can we dig in a little bit more deeply? So this is just kind of a screenshot of, you know, one specific license that I had found. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, like, to the extent to which you want to dig into this, you can get some sense of what the equipment is, because you can see the, you know, the sort of bandwidths that are the frequencies that are being used and the kind of power output. And really interestingly, you know, kind of the time and place of where these transmissions were happening. And so kind of from there, you can, of course, pivot over to like Google Earth or Google Maps and start to just kind of take a look, like, what's going on here. This, I don't know how well you can see here, but there's sort of a pickup truck with an antenna on the back of it, which was kind of interesting to see, especially when you sort of see the broader landscapes here. I mean, there's absolutely nothing there, so kind of finding these access roads and these install sites are really interesting. Here's another one, certainly a bit more of a fully built structure. And I think it looks like it has a combination both of kind of networking sort of technology to connect these towers together, in addition to some sort of surveillance radar system. These sites sometimes get actually much more even, you know, sort of well-established. Of course, infrastructure is really difficult to run out to these places, so a lot of them have a degree of, you know, sort of self-generation in terms of power and things of the like. Sort of going through this, one of the things that kind of came to the surface for me was that it's actually extremely hard to, from a technical perspective, to build this sort of border surveillance technology. There was a really famous, as I found out, sort of like disaster that happened in terms of, you know, government, as far as government contracting goes, where Boeing, I think under President George W. Bush, had gotten a really big contract. They basically said, you know, hey, for I think, you know, $3 or $4 billion, we'll be able to take care of the whole border with like a super high-tech surveillance system. But I mean, what actually wound up happening, I think, is it wound up costing them $1 billion to just do 53 miles of the border. And you know, a lot of the challenges that they apparently were running into were, I mean, in terms of actually being able to, you know, identify people versus grass moving or animals and things like that, and being able to work in these very kind of remote, inhospitable places. But, you know, I think one of the things that is quite interesting to me about this is, you know, this is a project that wound up getting shut down, I think, back in 2011. And of course, now that there's so much kind of increased, you know, attention sort of effort being put towards things like border security, this data, I think, can provide a very interesting lens into, you know, what is the government actually doing, what, you know, sort of what sorts of surveillance technologies are we purchasing, and maybe what are the broader kind of implications of that. You know, I think one of the things that for me is a big takeaway around all of this is that there's a tremendous amount of kind of public information out there, and one of the really, I think, fun and interesting challenges as a researcher, you know, in whatever capacity you might work, is to sort of think about how can we find these sort of lateral connections and other sources of information. Because, of course, as we know, the truth is out there. We just have to find it, hopefully. So that's all I have for you guys today. This is, again, the kind of repo, if you're interested in. I think we still have some time, so I'd be happy to take any questions, if there are any. Okay. Thank you.
Is this data getting used as economic signals by sort of people following markets, people finding out things about companies? One would imagine that this would be a significant economic sort of activity indicator. Is that something, have people figured out that the various pieces of data that you are talking about here can be used for that purpose?
I think you're absolutely right to call out the fact that there probably is a lot of really interesting signal in, you know, in these sort of obscure data sets that could be used for those sorts of purposes. I think we're still in a world where a lot of this data is still kind of quite clumped, like really difficult to work with, really obscure. And you know, I don't personally know of any examples of this being used for like trading algorithms or things like that. But one could certainly imagine it, I'd say.
Hi, this was great, thank you. I had a question about the flight path data. Is that available before the flights happen, or is it something that's posted afterwards? Like, what's the lead time there?
So I think there's two pieces of it. One is using this kind of ADS-B receiver.
Yeah.
That's actually kind of getting real-time position data of where the flights are. So that, of course, they've got to be in the air and moving, and that's where that data comes from. Separately from that, and this is not something I'm a full expert on, but I do know that planes do file flight path or flight plan data with the FAA ahead of time. And I think it is obtainable. If it's something you're interested in, I would suggest looking up a woman named Margot Williams, who is the research editor at The Intercept. And she's done a tremendous amount of work on this. But it does exist. I don't think it's like certainly not at the extent that there's an API and you can query it, but there are ways of doing it. But just as a final caveat, I think there's some complexity about not all planes may be needing to file it. And just as a last point, some planes can kind of opt out of, if you have a security or privacy concern, you can opt out of some of these flight tracking systems.
Well, I was just wondering about predictive ability around like sensitive areas, like protests or something, if you could figure that out in advance. But that's really cool. Thank you.
Absolutely, yeah.
Hello. So do you foresee or do you suspect there might be any risks to supply chains based on the fact that you can track ships and figure out and that it's public to see what's on the ships, what's in the containers? What sort of attacks do you think might actually be facilitated by this information?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I know certainly, piracy has been a big issue forever, you know, in places like, I think, the Malacca Straits and elsewhere. I don't actually know enough about how, like, sort of the sort of functioning of piracy crime and sort of what the motivations, sort of like, I don't know that to the extent to which they're offloading material versus, what the kind of financial end game winds up being. But I think certainly, I mean, you know, if people are enterprising in their sort of crime planning, one could imagine it being used.
Okay. And final aside, what's the lead time on getting that data from the, I forgot exactly who provides it.
Yeah, the Customs and Border Protection.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, I know that it's only published on a daily basis, but there is a combination of both kind of trailing and lagging shipments. So some people advance file bill of lading, so you can kind of see things ahead of time. Others, you're just kind of getting a rear view mirror look at it.
Hi. So you mentioned, of course, the BuzzFeed planes story, and Intercept has done some things, and there's a court story and a few things, I think, around Davos. So there's a burgeoning like SDR investigative journalism scene. Is it your sense that this is still something that is technically difficult enough that there's a lot of pasture there, or is this something that you think is there an area where you think see that expanding, or where journalists can be doing more work in that area?
Definitely. I mean, I think the thing that's really kind of cool and interesting is that the technical difficulty has sort of, you know, is just like reducing daily, especially as more and more great kind of like guides and things like that are written. And so I think that opens up the field for a lot of creativity. I'll give you an example. There was someone did a project where they set up one of these receivers in somewhere in Switzerland, either Zurich or wherever. And basically, like, what they were trying to do is see when, like, dictator planes were going to visit their Swiss banks or whatever. What was interesting is, like, they, you know, manually had identified, like, some handful, dozens or whatever, of tail numbers that they said, okay, these are, you know, dictator airplanes or whatever. But I think the kind of interesting investigative work in a context like that is, I think, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. I'm sure there's, you know, thousands of planes that could be of interest in this regard. I'm thinking about, you know, how would you expand a corpus like that? And then what do you do once you actually find, oh, you know, this particular head of state is traveling here at this time? You know, how can we kind of dig further with that?
The technical issues aside, you know, obviously these, a lot of these, you know, this stuff is capable with $20 sticks you could buy on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Are there regulatory issues that prohibit the reception of licensed spectrum for, you know, swaths of these frequencies?
So, you know, I'm certainly not a full expert on it and wouldn't want to be, you know, giving kind of guidance to anyone in that regard. My understanding is for the most part, you know, the regulation really kicks in when you're starting to transmit stuff. I do know that some states have regulations around, like, receiving police scanner data when you're in, like, a vehicle that's in motion, and there's certainly local regulation about those things. But my general understanding, and I would encourage you to find someone who actually knows the answer, is that when you're receiving things, it's generally fine.
All right. Can you come up with a better title for this talk than Making Sense of the Ether?
I'd be open to suggestions. Do you have one?
Well, I have to write one down.
Please do, and bring it up after the talk. I'd love to see it. Thank you.
Hey, great talk. So you talked a lot about unencrypted radio protocols. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, do you see encrypted ones much? And do you have any interesting ones that you could talk about a little bit?
Yeah, it's there's definitely a of course a bunch of that going on. There's been actually, some of the interesting at least attacks that I've seen in that regard are around sort of like replay attacks. So there's been a lot of sort of work and research done around intervening with remote car starts and remote car kind of door unlocks and things like that, where people have been able to not necessarily get so far as actually decrypting and understanding what the signals were, but being close enough to just actually record them and then be able to replay them at a later time to gain access to it. But it's certainly, there's also an interesting project that some Eastern European artists did, or perhaps Brazilian, around sort of identifying the sort of transmission frequencies that like military planes use, and sort of created an artwork that just sort of indicated when there were sort of, you know, transmissions on those frequencies, even if they didn't know what they were actually saying. The kind of presence of them was interesting and something that they created like an interface for.
Hi, excellent talk. Thank you very much. What I'm so amazed at is I live in the Northeast. I hear transatlantic flights still on HF. Like 3.4 megahertz, and they'll go ahead and announce themselves to Gander that, hey, I'm going to do transatlantic. But I was always trying to figure out, is Gander in those will acknowledge airplane, and they'll like stand by for your tone, and you hear something that sounds like almost touch tones are sending out in the HF frequency. Huh. Do you know, have an idea what that is? I'm sure it's a very old system, because I went to go look up the system, and like there's documented files of protocol of they actually have to use HF for transatlantic as like a backup. I was just amazed that with all the satellites and everything else, that was still something to be done.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Unfortunately, I don't know much about it, but I'd love to learn more.
Yeah, in RTL SDR, and if you tune in around between 3.5 and 3.3 megahertz, you'll hear stuff. And it's just interesting. And then you can just take they'll say the tail number of the plane, and you just go ahead and flightaware.com, like, okay, who is that? So. Thank you.
Cool, thanks. And I think if there's time for one more question, if there is any. Okay, otherwise, well, thank you guys very much. This was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.